I'm talking about something very, very serious, and I guess a lot from the heart this morning. And part of it is modified as a result of what has happened during this half hour this morning. In the discussions last night on the novel, it was Carol's feeling that he would initiate the discussion on sort of what you see in the novel and in reading see. And he thought, well, I should, and he'd help me, he said, today to look more at the hearing part of it. Well, I'll get to some of that. But I have to express some real concerns that I have, and I'm doing this because many of you are my contemporaries and have seen some of what I have. And part of it stems from my experience too, as a unwanted guest of the Third Reich. I have lived under a totalitarian system, and as a result of that, I have very, very deep concerns for our present situation. And I'm going to depart from my partially prepared text to address that issue. And John says it's a little too hot a fire, so he's going to slow it down. He's the draft. He's going to close the damper on.
That fire up in the roof a couple of times. Three logs is the maximum.
Okay, we'll remember that. The and the first thing then I want to talk about relative to my concerns has to do with what's been going on recently in the various areas of communication. Virtually every area, every medium of communication that's available today has been experimenting with new ways of mingling facts and fiction. Doctorow, who is author of Ragtime, in the book area, has done this. Dramatizations. Have appeared on television. Probably the one that will hit home the most might be the Adams Chronicles. And that ain't all fact. As a result, the contemporary scene is one in which people are asked to regard fictional movies as if they are real, and real movies as if they are fiction. It should not surprise us then that people are beginning to show signs of regarding real events, things happening to them and around them, as though they were movies. And I think an example of this is the recent financial crisis in New York. And I won't take time to read something unless we run we will have time left over. But many people today seem to have lost the capacity for believing in the reality of events in their own life. And why this hits me so hard is that people, I don't think they fully comprehend what might be happening. In the recent past, American constitutional democracy has been placed in great peril. Questions have been raised relative to whether, in fact, it will survive even this decade. Recent conditions made our time one in which perhaps the most serious threat to liberty in America, in our American history, can take place. The time was one of sleep. I believe that our democracy is a very fragile thing indeed, and without concern and nurture and continuing vigilance, we stand to lose it. And I'm going to have more to say about this, why it's so important. And because of what Ron read earlier today, and because of what I have been reading, I want to share also a few readings with you. And we're eventually going to get back to the novel. But there's a reason for doing this. And I think the way I will do it is to introduce a very important author to you. An important author to me who I only recently discovered. In hopes that you will read some of her writing. And then I'm going to share just a few things that she has written with you that addresses this issue. And then we're going to get into why the novel is so important and why we as a free people are important. And I'm also going to tell something about the importance of hearing. But last December the 4th, our world lost one of its leading political philosophers when Hannah Arendt died. She was 69. She wrote several books. One of them was The Origins of Totalitarianism, which she wrote in 1951. And it is unparalleled, really, for its clarity of its analysis and the inescapability of its conclusions. It is the basis for some of the discussion that we are going to have. A commentator in the New Yorker said, with her death, it was as if some counterweight to all the world's unreason and corruption has been removed. She was not only a political philosopher, but also a great teacher. She was a moral and intellectual force that went beyond category. Her influence upon artists and political people around the world, as well as intellectuals, was deep and profound. Through them, she touched millions of lives who have really never heard of her. She was born and educated in Germany, which she left in 1933. She went to France, and in 1941, she escaped from France along with her husband and came to America. She taught at Princeton, at Columbia, and at Chicago, University of Chicago. And it was shortly after her coming to America that she began to write this book on the origins of totalitarianism. And I think a very significant part of her writing is this, that she saw anti-Semitism as a common factor in the origins of modern totalitarian systems. They arise when the confident individual has vanished and society has been reduced to an atomistic mass dependent only on the state. She maintained that the European Jewish bourgeoisie culture was the principal major stumbling block to totalitarianism, for it emphasized the individual's personal relationships and his position, his or her position. It is important that much of what she said about Jewishness as a social phenomenon also applies to Christianity, especially to evangelical Christianity with its distinctive beliefs, lifestyle, and common tendencies. Again and again, she disclosed insights and concepts which altered the cultural and intellectual life of our time. And as the years passed, it became very plain she was one of those rare thinkers in history who are empowered to move human thought forward, who can add something to our knowledge and understanding of ourselves, and who can push back the boundaries of where our mind can go. Her ideas, as original as they were, had about them the normality and inevitability of truths that were waiting to be found. Once she wrote that even in the darkest of times, we have a right to expect illumination. And I believe the novel, the right kind of novel, is that kind of illumination. And I think we can say that in the dark times that we have passed through, she herself has been a steady source of light. Her awesome mind set her apart from most people, yet she managed to remain the human family. She had a tender attachment to her husband, who died a few years ago. And the warmth and vigor she brought to her friendships and relationships with her students was something to behold. Devotion to what she regarded as the obligations of citizens, and her ardent response to music and books, and in her respectful attention to the details of everyday living, she was indeed human. She abhorred moral and mental slackness in others, and she made immoderate demands upon herself. Her rectitude was extreme. She wasted none of her energy and none of her time on the pursuit of notice, honors, or any other rewards that came to her. She preserved her remarkable gifts and her strengths for her work, her marriage, her students, and her friends. She was constantly teaching, whether it was in the classroom, in her writings, and ordinary conversation. People naturally seemed to turn to her for answers to their questions. Seldom uncertain in her judgment, she knew what she thought and where she stood. Through her life, she revered the philosopher Jaspers, who was her own teacher at Heidelberg. She also revered the poets of the world as though she did not know, and it is possible that she did not know, that cerebration itself, when it was hers, became poetry. Late every Thursday afternoon over the years, she and her two friends met in their modest apartment on Riverside Drive, New York, to read Plato and the classics together. She was in her element with Plato, just as he probably would have been at home with her. The last writing she completed was a book on thinking, which I have been unable to find so far, and perhaps it hasn't been published. Without a doubt, thinking was one of her subjects. She, as much as perhaps anyone who has ever lived, knew what it is to think. And as an afterthought, like the Jewish philosopher Martin Buber, whose inquiry into the nature of the encounter between the individual and God furnishes much stimulation to Christians. Hannah Arendt has provided Christian thinkers with many insights into the political and social limits of the human condition, which is a subject she also addressed in her book, The Human Condition, which is regarded by some to be her best work. I just wanted to introduce you to Hannah Arendt. I one day sort of put this down. So I wanted you to be aware of an important writer. And what did she say? I'm just going to share just a few of these with you. Excuse me.
That aren't air.
A-R-E-N-D-T. And it has to do with totalitarianism. In her preface, in the introduction, she says that no doubt the fact that totalitarian government is open criminality notwithstanding, rests on mass support, is very disquieting. A lot of people don't realize that. It is therefore hardly surprising that scholars as well as statesmen often refuse to recognize it, the former by believing in the magic of propaganda and brainwashing, and the latter by simply denying it, as for instance Adenauer did repeatedly. And then she recalls a publication in Germany, and which she thought was very good. She said it's very revealing in this respect. It shows first that the population of Germany was very well informed about the so-called secrets, massacres of the Jews in Poland, and the preparation for the attack on Russia. When I was a prisoner there, they talked about the barbaric Russians in their discussions with me. And as if they didn't know anything about these other things. I am among those who have witnessed the walking dead. And you can't see that and forget it. And the second, the extent to which the victims of propaganda had remained able to form independent opinions. However, the point of the matter is that this did not in the least weaken the general support of the Hitler regime. It is quite obvious that mass support for totalitarianism comes neither from ignorance nor from brainwashing. And in 1940, when I was in my undergraduate days, there were people there who thought Hitler was a real great guy, and that was in this state of Washington. And here in the final part of her, in the rewrite of this, really, in her introduction that was completed in 1966, she said this: "The most dramatic new element in this last purge, which Stalin planned in the last years of his life, was a decisive shift in ideology, the introduction of a Jewish world conspiracy. For years, the ground for this change had been carefully laid in a number of trials in the satellite countries," and she then recalls for us the trials in Hungary, the Anna Pauker affair in Romania, and the Slansky trial in Czechoslovakia. "In these preparatory measures, high party officials were singled out because of their Jewish bourgeoisie origins and accused of Zionism. This accusation was generally changed to implicate notoriously non-Zionist agencies, especially the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, in order to indicate that all Jews were Zionists and all Zionist groups hirelings of American imperialism. There was, of course, nothing new in the crime of Zionism, but as the campaign progressed and began to center on Jews in the Soviet Union, another significant change took place. Jews now stood accused of cosmopolitanism rather than Zionism, and the pattern of accusations that developed out of this slogan followed ever more closely the Nazi pattern of a Jewish world conspiracy in the sense of the elders of Zion. It now became startlingly clear how deep an impression this mainstay of Nazi ideology must have made on Stalin. The first indications of this had been in evidence ever since the Hitler-Stalin pact, partly to be sure because of its obvious propaganda value in Russia. As in all the satellite countries where anti-Jewish feeling was widespread, in the anti-Jewish propaganda had always enjoyed great popularity, but partly also because this type of fictitious world conspiracy provided an ideologically more suitable background for totalitarian complaints to world rule than Wall Street, capitalism, and imperialism. The open, unashamed adoption of what had become to the whole world the most prominent sign of Nazism was the last compliment Stalin paid to his late colleague and rival in total domination, with whom, much to his chagrin, he had not been able to come to a lasting agreement. Stalin, like Hitler, died in the midst of a horrifying, unfinished business. And when this happened, the story this book has to tell and the events it tries to understand and to come to terms with came to at least a provisional end. And that serves to introduce it. And now I'm just going to read you one other, I think only one other thing, if I can find it. And this because it really ties in with what Ron brought to your attention, and I'm glad he did that this morning, because it really serves to introduce something that is very important and the novel really is an enemy of. It would be still more serious mistake to forget, because of this impermanence, that the totalitarian regimes, so long as they are in power, and the totalitarian leaders, so long as they are alive, command and rest upon mass support up to the end. Hitler's rise to power was legal in terms of majority rule, and neither he nor Stalin could have maintained the leadership of large populations, survived many interior and exterior crises, and braved the numerous dangers of relentless intra-party struggles if they had not had the confidence of the masses. The widespread belief that Hitler was simply an agent of German industrialists and Stalin was victorious in the succession struggle after Lenin's death, only through a sinister conspiracy, are both legends, which can be refuted by many facts, but above all, by the leader's indisputable popularity. Nor can their popularity be attributed to the victory of masterful and lying propaganda over ignorance and stupidity. For the propaganda of totalitarian movements, which precede and accompany totalitarian regimes, is invariably as frank as it is mendacious. That is, it's a damn lie. Huh? And would-be totalitarian leaders usually start their careers by boasting of their past crimes and carefully outlining their future ones. The Nazis were convinced that evil doing in our time has a morbid force of attraction. And it has. Bolshevik assurances inside and outside Russia that they do not recognize ordinary moral standards have become a mainstay of communist propaganda. And experiences prove time and again that the propaganda value of evil deeds and general contempt for moral standards is independent of mere self-interest, supposedly the most powerful psychological factor in politics. The attraction of evil and crime for the mob mentality is nothing new. It has always been true that the mob will greet deeds of violence with the admiring remark, "It may be mean, but it is very clever." The disturbing factor in the success of totalitarianism is rather the true selflessness of its adherents. It may be understandable that a Nazi or a Bolshevik will not be shaken in his conviction by crimes against people who do not belong to the movement or are even hostile to it. But the amazing fact is that neither is he likely to waver when the monster begins to devour its own children, and not even if he becomes a victim of persecution himself. If he is framed or condemned, if he is purged from the party and sent to a forced labor camp or a concentration camp, on the contrary to the wonder of the whole civilized world, he may even be willing to help in his own prosecution and frame his own death sentence if only his status as a member of the movement is not touched. It would be naive to consider this stubbornness of convictions, which outlives all actual experiences and cancels all immediate self-interest and simple expression of fervent idealism. Idealism, foolish or heroic, always springs from some individual decision and conviction and is subject to experience and argument. The fanaticism of totalitarian movements, contrary to all forms of idealism, breaks down the moment the movement leaves its fanaticized followers in the lurch, killing in them any remaining conviction that might have survived the collapse of the movement itself. But within the organizational framework of the movement, so long as it holds together, the fanaticized members may reach may be reached by neither experience nor argument. Identification with the movement and total conformism seem to have destroyed the very capacity for experience, even if it be as extreme as torture or fear of death. So I recommend that for you for reading and much thought. And it's indeed disturbing to me, and I hope it's disturbing to you. Now, just a bit on hearing and listening. You were introduced to the seeing last night, and I said I'd just say a few words about hearing. If you want to hear my listening talk, I'm not going to give it to you now. And I'm not on this subject given much to joking. I don't take myself very seriously, but I don't have any real good jokes for you right now. But you can get a few on my tape on listening, and it may be helpful to some of you, as some of you have told me. But on this subject of listening, it is so true that you have ears but you do not hear. I suppose 98% of what you and I learn, we learn through our eyes and our ears. As to the breakdown of this, there have been many studies on it, and I will not go into the detail of that. But these studies have indicated that probably for many people, 70% of their day may be spent in some form of communication. Perhaps 10% in writing for some, depending on your vocation. 15% perhaps in reading. 25 to 30% in speaking, and probably 45% in listening. And as you examine how you have prepared for this, you realize that you have academically, in academic pursuit, some of it formal, you have learned how to read, how to write, and more recently, how to speak, because more and more courses on speaking are being given. But very few of you have had a course in comprehensive listening, yet it's the thing we do most of. And that's because we have not had this, paid much attention to it until very recently. Most of you are probably like most other people, that if I gave you a test on what I think you should have recalled from my lecture today, there would probably be roughly a 50% retention of what I said to you today, and if I wait 2 days, you'll be down to 25% or less. Some of you will be considerably less than that. And that's laying it on you kind of heavy. But it's true. And so we must pay attention to this. But I'm going to tell you some of the things that we are hearing now. But there's a statement that goes like this. I know you believe you understand what you think I've said, but I'm not sure you realize that what you heard is not what I meant. And if that doesn't make, if you don't comprehend that, that's understandable. But that's sort of how it is. It's how a lot of things sound to us. We don't always say what we mean, and we do not comprehend nonverbal communication, and there's many holes in our system, which I have discussed in this tape on listening. But there are five levels of need on listening that you must be, I think, helpfully aware of. It isn't all, it's kind of neat to categorize these things, but it doesn't always work that way. But they're the five S's. I've never discussed these before here, but some of you I know have heard them. On the first level is survival. Death may be imminent in such a situation. You may have terminal illness. The second level has to do with security. Perhaps your way of life or your job is threatened. The means of support is threatened. At the third level, it's social. The need to belong to groups where you feel you're in or you're cared for. On the fourth S level, it's status. You like maybe your name in the paper, promotion, a bigger house or car, something along that line. And the fifth one is satisfaction. Special gourmet cooking. You don't have to. That happens to be a way of life here, but good clothes or foreign travel or whatever it might be that you like. And if you're talking to someone Well, I'll give you an illustration. When I was in prison camp, or I'm sure the Hinderleys were in prison camp, when you're really hungry, when it's a matter that you may be in a situation where the chances of your survival are compromised, you don't hear much talk, at least I didn't, about girls or about foreign travel, about what kind of a job you're going to get her. What kind of a car you're going to get. Didn't hear a thing about it. You can only talk to that person where his level is, in a way, because they aren't going to hear you on some other subject. You have to be where they are. You have to put yourself where they are. And that's about all I'm going to say about that. Not long ago, it's within the last couple of years, you call the European Security Conference at Helsinki, Brezhnev said, "It is no secret that information media can serve the purposes of peace and confidence, or they can spread throughout the world the poison of discord between countries and people." We would like to hope that the results of the conference will serve as a correct guideline for cooperation in these areas. Now, according to the party line, that we are operating under these days, these last few years, both dissidents within the Soviet Union and criticism without must be suppressed in the name of detente. The Soviet Union, of course, lacks a free press. It finds itself under the critical eye, however, only of the free press of the world in the few countries that have that. And if you've been a student of this in the last few decades, since the start of the UN, the number of votes from a free people are diminishing, if you haven't noticed. They're diminishing remarkably. And the free press provides a voice for dissidents within the Soviet Union to make their voices known. Now, China, of course, is a rival totalitarian regime to Russia. But it can't amplify the voice of a Solzhenitsyn or a Sakharov. The reason for this, in my estimation, is that a voice from any unfree nation is suspect. Maybe as suspect as the Soviet Union. They're not going to believe it. At least the thinking people won't believe it, hopefully. Only voices that emanate from the atmosphere of freedom can win the trust that gives them their power. Now, recently in India and quite a few other countries, you have seen a suppression of free speech and press. And not long ago in Czechoslovakia, police were breaking into writers' apartments and confiscating manuscripts before the texts could be disseminated. The free world must serve as really a memory for these nations who want to extirpate their past and present. That's part of the work of the novel. By securing and perfecting our liberties, the world is able to serve the globe as a librarian and as a sounding board, as a custodian of whatever can be known or imagined, and we're going to talk about imagination in the next hour, about the world, a world that does not want to know much about itself. I've already expressed my concern the mingling of fact and fiction. Now, as to the novel, I want to open this up now for any remarks you want to make. And I'll start it out with the Russian novel. In my busy schedule, I do try to take out a little time during the year at the university in which I serve, to drop in on the class on the Russian novel. It's taught by a good friend of mine who was raised, born and raised in Russia and then came to the United States. He's a scientist. I'm sure Al knows him, Igor Kozin. But he also teaches the Russian novel. And in this semester, he is having, he's enlisted a series of these Russian novels, and he has one by Solzhenitsyn. He might have more by Solzhenitsyn, but what he does is to, he only uses those novels that the Russians read, or are allowed to read. And I think of, unless I'm wrong, and I'd want to be corrected in this, I believe about the only one of Solzhenitsyn's novels that the Russians have, that has been released in Russia is One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. And I think they think that's a mistake now. But it was after Stalin, Khrushchev, in his sort of a remaking Russia, he allowed this to be released. And if you read it, you'll probably realize why they probably wished it wasn't released. It's a great book. I identify with it probably because more than most of you, because of some of the situation. I don't say that I've gone through all of that. I probably wouldn't have made it. But you get the real feel. You're living through it. As Carol so well pointed out last night, the benefit of the novel is that it puts you there. And I could realize the cold. One of the terrible things of a prison camp in certain areas is the hunger and the cold. And I swore I'd never be cold again. That's why I always wear a lot of coats. You see me always with a lot of coats. And I usually have chow in my tie or in my bag or somewhere. So I identify with this. But I think you'll also find something very useful in it. And Solzhenitsyn is a person we must listen to today. America has tried to categorize him. Our president didn't want him in Washington. And the commentators had a lot of difficulty with him because he didn't fit in any of the pigeonholes. The Britishers sort of didn't take him too seriously and sort of made fun of him. Mary will have more to say about that, I'm sure. I think the other thing that I liked about Ivan Denisovich was the character Alyoshka in there. And I think it serves as a statement of his own faith, the faith of Solzhenitsyn. Because freedom to Alyoshka had nothing to do with the terrible conditions of the Siberian prison camp, the barbed wire and the horrible conditions, because it was inside of him and God-given. It was in the scripture, in the gospels that he had secreted away and that he read every day. Now, some of you, especially you who are younger, I'm sure sort of question. You probably say, well, that old gummer, he's he's an old-fashioned character that he probably sees a communist under every chair and behind every bedpost. That isn't the point of my story. I would just ask you, if you question it, just to do one thing. You don't have to read the whole Gulag Archipelago. Just read through the arrest. Just read through the arrest. And then you'll know how it is when you lose your freedom. Because I lost mine. I learned about freedom the hard way. By losing it. By losing it. And I don't recommend that. It's better to secure it so you don't lose it. And the cost of that is continual vigilance. And that's why I feel very strongly about the novel. The good novel which you're going to now get a list of. And to really understand thereby what is really going on. Now, Carol, where are you?
Right back here.
You can correct what I've said and then...
I wrote him here today. That's his committed weakness. And that's where we all come in.
Yeah, and in that regard on Solzhenitsyn, a lot of people said the Russians, they made a mistake by letting Solzhenitsyn out. No, they didn't. He's a non-person in Russia. He's a non-person. He was a free voice in a way, and they couldn't afford him. He's a non-person.
You mean then they don't believe him, they don't listen to him?
They don't hear him. Very few Russians hear him, I think. You, what do you think, Carol?
No, they don't hear him.
At least this is what my Russian teacher tells me. He's a non-person.
But you hear him if you hear him on the BBC.
There's very few people hear that. Mm-hmm.
They can't do that.
They're not allowed. No, I mean in America.
We hear him. No question about that. He's made a great impact. I'm glad they did.
Yeah,
huh?
That's what I mean.
Yeah, I see. But for the Russians, that's what they're concerned.
But that's their weakness. I used to wish the Japanese guard had asked me the questions that they were asking some of the other fellows. They never did, but I had my answer ready. You want to tell Rawson, who do you think is going to win the war? They asked, you know, when you were working on details. And I also told you, I just tell them the side that isn't afraid to hear what the other side has to say. Finally, that's true. It doesn't. People make fun of Luther at this point, because that was his point. In the long run, you know. Well, so it takes 450 years. but it is the side that wins.
Do you think Russia has bowed a little bit to world opinion and letting some of the Jews migrate? Is that the reason they're doing it?
I'm no Russian expert. The commentators I read, some of them maintain that this is very important. They do respond to some pressures. In the science area, they have responded to some pressures by our own National Academy, by the statement of the National Academy of Sciences. I don't have the statement here, in which I have subscribed to, to allow some release, but. In the scientific meetings, it may be of interest to you that, and this varies a good deal, how who they can trust and how far they trust them. But I've been to many meetings in which there have been Russians listed for their talks. Some of them we'd recognize from the literature, some not. But more often than not, they do not appear. And somebody else comes along, and sometimes they're political hacks, and they read them. Now, that isn't always true. There's a few, like the Radiation Research Congress in Seattle, the international one, just, 3 years ago. Some of those fellows I knew from before, but one of them, who I was looking forward to seeing, who had been a guest in my home in California, Muscula, I think he'd fallen in bad times, but he was alone when he came to California to visit us. And he was in my home, and after that he always sent me a card about Christmas time. It wasn't a Christmas card, but he always sent me greetings. But he didn't show up in National Congress, but there were a lot of several people who we did not recognize from the field of science. And it's kind of it kind of surprises us as kind of a way to run a ship. And when I was at the International Physiological Congress in Munich about 4 years ago, The fellow in front of me was a Russian, cashing his chips, getting the currency of Germany. And he got a fantastic amount of money. And I wrote that down. And I think, fantastic to me at that time was, I think it was $1,500, $2,000. And I wondered what the world he was up to. And so he was a fellow, once you've seen him, it sort of haunts you. I mean, he doesn't look like everybody else in the street. And so I kind of checked on him, and I never saw him in any scientific meetings, but periodically I'd see him with some of the other Russians. And I think he was the one that passed out the dough and sort of gave him the instructions. And I saw him, in fact, passing out the dough to him, but he probably limited their allowances. And I doubt if he's a scientist. But that's the system. And some of the writings that we have in Russian literature, they have undergone laundering. They were written, and then a new regime or something comes in, and they laundry them. And some of what we read in the Russian writings in the class are, and you see that they're writing for the purpose of state. Hey, can you say it a little louder, Bill?
And you ought to see in the Olympics. Now, it doesn't come out of compassion, in my view, though. And I know you didn't suggest that, but it comes perhaps out of one of your next efforts, the status. It's important to the Russian regime to have the world understand they do have some fine scientists, that they have that, and that they have the outstanding athletes, and that's the only reason why they're committed, is it not?
Yeah. It's pretty much a calculated risk. You take a chance of losing. They suffered a bad one on that airplane the other day,
and that's hurting them a bit, probably.
Well, they're probably the most advanced fighter in the world. Flew into Japan and being disassembled by some Americans.
Yeah.
Yeah, you.
What's going to happen to him, Doctor? I mean, he's sure he's escaped the United States, but that would be.
There are those here who are probably looking for him, as they did for the ambassador to Chile the other day, and they catch up with him, and that's a risk. It's a big risk. They have long memories, and it isn't the kind of life you like to live.
Imagine he'll be under scrutiny for a...
Oh, yeah.
That says something about what he escaped from, doesn't it? He's going to live that kind of a life as a matter of choice. Say something about the sheer terror,
Yeah, he has to know that this is a risk, but he's going to spend the rest of his life looking over his shoulder.
Well, the soul for nothing have to do that.
Not really.
Not really. Not so much. They don't wish him well.
But to do him in would create a horror for the world, whereas in this other case, people would say, well, okay, he took a chance and he got it. Hoping he's in a different situation. This is the other man's military.
Don't you think they play on the basics of survival? If you don't play my way, it still gets down to the beast in us that we want to survive, we want to live. Is that what they played on you in the camp? Trying your kids, your survival, so that your survival is the most important, and then you will go along with what they will do?
Yeah.
The Christian doesn't always believe that. It's our moral survival on earth does not matter too much.
Yeah, you have control over a person. If you always keep them in an insecure state, don't you? And you're his source of salvation in a way. You're the one that gives him the bread. Like that's why as Carol pointed out yesterday, and it's so important, on the Brothers Karamazov. Huh? We've taken care of it now. We bread and happiness is yours, huh? You're our slaves.
Deal there that, I mean, just like thinking about Missouri Synod right now, with people lining up to Jack Price who know he's wrong, who know he's turning the gospel to the law, and yet their group ego, their feeling of tradition, their fathers. I mean, in Russia, this plays, I think, a huge part. The crazy thing there is that to be a Russian is to be guilty. You know, in the Gulag Archipelago, you're guilty. You don't have to prove anything. You're Russian, aren't you? Okay, well, so this. And yet, at the same time, the other side of it is played up. And that tricky group ego thing. And that's what scared me. The first 4th of July communion we had here at the village when it was forbidden by the Missouri Synod. And I don't know if you're here or not, but Paul Haynes, Missouri Synod pastor, and I'm an ALC pastor, he said, it's time we Lutherans quit letting the Gestapo run us. And we opened up a communion table for all God's children, which in America still is against the general party line of our meant that we were outside the pale, so either one of us would get a call with nothing to eat. And yet we knew what we were doing was our Lord's will and right. It's his suffering. But this is the group ego that destroys that sense of the body of Christ. Like and so many of you are sick, and Paul goes on that. When you destroy that continuity with the whole human situation that Chris is talking about. And you can see you know when it's happening, when you're scared, when you realize that certain people dearly aren't going to be talking to you, when you know you're not going to sleep so well. Siggy has a beautiful letter, 5 pages, and he's been awake through the night till 5 o'clock several nights in a row. Finally, he had to write it. A little comment made last Sunday that if you're silent in over when the gospel is turned into law, you betray Christ and his church, is the line with which he preached. He was hoping it gets published by Missouri City, but I don't think it will be. They're saying everything's okay, we're all over and so on, and they just know, you know, but just got knocked out from Illinois. And then we have everybody think it's okay and knock out another guy. Everything's fine, we're going fine, knock out another guy. Typical Russian politics that Jack Price has, and he's a Norwegian. And he's not done. Neither was Putin. Putin was the highest mark that anybody ever came to Norwegian military. There's certain kinds of minds for which this has a great appeal. You control people out of terror, and then you know how to handle them. Terror on the one hand, and your arm around them on the other. And that's why that Arnie Flatton sculpture, I've always liked it, this odd of the hands out of all the scholarships for schools and stuff. Stanford Foundation bought it, where a guy is being patted on the head by his father and being choked at the same time with the other arm. Paternalism.
Now, who is the admiral of the German, in the German Navy in the First World War? Wasn't he the one that said, you know, the Nazis came and first they got the labor unions, but I wasn't in the labor union, so I didn't raise my voice. And they got the Jews, and I wasn't a Jew, so I didn't bother with that. When they get the labor unions, I didn't raise my voice on that. And then they came after the Catholics, and I wasn't a Catholic. And then they came and got me, and there wasn't anybody to raise their voice.
Well, the words of Patricia Nixon, you know, never underestimate the power of fear. Just speaking of, very happy with the fact that the reason why certain demonstrations against the Vietnam War could be suppressed so easily was that they were scared.
Yeah, and this whole thing of logic, I think I remember something here. One of my laws states that to think that man acts logically is illogical. And the same goes for women. Hannah Arendt said this, I know of no time when the future of the world has been more unpredictable, nor a time when we were depending on political forces that could not be trusted to respect common sense or even self-interest. It's nothing short of insanity. We seem to have two camps, Those who believe that anything is possible, it's just a matter of organizing for it. And those for whom powerlessness has become the major experience of their life. I think that's well stated. As there's an old Chinese proverb. No, it's not a proverb, it's a Chinese curse. We live in, may you live in interesting times. And we do.